Welcome to part two of the MMA Lawcast for this week as we break down the main card of UFC 300. If you guys are looking for the prelims, check the pinned comment if you're watching on YouTube or check the bumper above me as well. I should have it on the description as well for the audio podcast, but I did drop the prelim breakdown for you guys yesterday. So if you're looking for that again, check that out. Otherwise, on this episode and this part, we are covering just the main card for the big UFC 300 event. And I'm very much looking forward to doing that. As a reminder, I am your host, Manpreet, aka MMA Lock of the Night, your boy on social media at MMA LOTN, and the architect behind the MMA Fight Archive, ensuring you leave no stone unturned when you're researching these upcoming MMA events. With a total of 17 different promotions from all over the world on the Fight Archive, we have close to 3,500 fighter profiles on there as well. There's a reason the top analysts, handicappers, coaches, fighters, and commentators utilize this service so that they are able to effectively analyze, predict, and break down all of these upcoming matchups. You can check it out for free as well with a 7-day free trial. Link for that is in the description below. So make sure you guys check that out and take full advantage of all of the direct links to past fights for all of the competitors competing on these upcoming events. All right, like I said, we are breaking down UFC 300, the main card. I've already done all the weekend recaps on the prelim episode. I've done my intro on the prelim episode. I don't need to do all of that good stuff, so we can get right into the breakdowns. But I quickly want to let you guys know and remind you that the PFL card is going down this Friday as well, and I should be dropping that breakdown for you guys on Wednesday. So keep your eyes peeled Wednesday evening as I break down that card for you guys for free on the YouTube channel as well as all podcasting platforms. We got an action-packed weekend of fights culminating with UFC 300, so make sure you guys stay strapped into the content that drops throughout the week. Top three lock of the night candidates, top three dog of the night candidates, the free parlay, the quick picks, and not to mention the three best prop bets as well. I got you guys fully covered. Hit that subscribe if you haven't already, and check out the rest of the great content on the YouTube channel. All right, without further ado, let's get right into it. Curtain jerker for the main card goes down in the middleweight division as we have Bo Nickel coming in as a minus 2,300 prohibitive favorite going up against Mr. Cody Brundage, who comes in at plus 1,100. No need to get too deep into this matchup. We know what we're getting into. Just a quick background on Bo Nickel. We know what he's all about. High-level collegiate wrestling background. Probably one of the best wrestling prospects we've ever seen make the transition from collegiate wrestling to the mixed martial arts world. He is now 5-0. Two of those wins coming inside the UFC. Both of them coming by first-round finish. He has three submissions on his record as well as two knockouts, but the thing is clear that he doesn't like to go into the second round, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that he hasn't been facing the highest level of resistance, which often allows him to go out there and just run these opponents over. He is a guy that trains at American Top Team, has his own branch up by his neck of the woods as well, so cross training often as well. We know all the high level coaches and training partners that he has access to as well. We know that he's trying to improve his striking game to catch up to his wrestling, so he doesn't only have to rely on the wrestling, because at a certain point that wrestling is not going to work out for him and he's going to have to throw some fisticuffs to try to still end up getting his hand raised. His opponent this weekend, Cody Brundage, was originally public enemy number one going into his last matchup against Zachary Reese, as he had picked up a disqualification victory over Jacob Malkoon prior to that, and that was a matchup where he was pretty much trending towards the losing realm and possibly was going to end up getting cut, considering it would have been his fourth straight loss in a row. But illegal shots to the back of the head, deemed intentional by referee Mark Smith, caused that fight to go to a disqualification, giving Cody Brundage the win and forcing people to rip up the chalky parlays that they had with Jacob Malkoon that night. But Cody Brundage went out there and got an upset victory the right way by going out there and slam knocking out Mr. Zachary Reese, who suffered his first professional loss that night. Cody Brundage showcased that he's still capable of putting opponents out in weird and unorthodox ways, loves to really create chaos and try to find finishes in those aspects strikes, just like he did against Dalcha Lungiambula. But that's going to be very hard for him to do against a guy like Bo Nickel, who's so clean and easy to get to his game. Now, Brundage comes from a college wrestling background as well, but clearly not nearly on the level of Mr. Bo Nickel. And I expect Bo to really make a statement in that realm. I think he's going to want to showcase that he is the far superior wrestler. And I think we'll see him take Brundage down with relative ease in this matchup. And then from there, eventually smash his way to a finish, whether it's by submission or KO. From a betting perspective, the only way to play this fight really is try to hone in on the prop that you think is most valuable in this matchup. Cody Brundage to win by knockout is sitting at plus 130, if I remember correctly, while the submission prop is sitting at minus 140. I'm going to lean a little bit to the knockout prop, because when you have somebody as dominant on the ground as Bo Nickel or other wrestlers, usually the knockout or submission prop is a bit of a toss-up. You know, some guys have that jiu-jitsu background, so they're going to be searching for the submission. But Bo Nickel comes from a wrestling background and will more than likely take whatever finish comes his way. And I could potentially see an aspect here where he's able to get the back of Cody Brundage, gets him belly down, stretches him out, and then pounds him out from that back position. I'm going to go Brundage by TKO round one. Nickel by TKO round one. I think I said Brundage. But yeah, I think we've seen Nickel make it look fairly easy here. Minus 2,300. Don't put that in your parlays. Please don't do it. It doesn't add anything to your plays. And in case there is some sort of banana peel moment here, and that ends up being the only leg that ends up crashing, you're going to be hitting yourself for throwing him into the parlay. So try to hone in on something a little bit more valuable. And I think that's a method of victory prop here. And for me, it's going to be Nickel by TKO. All right, moving on to the next matchup here. High stakes, lightweight fight, which could probably determine the next number one contender. We got former champion Charles Dobronx Oliveira coming in at plus 190. He takes on Armand Sarukian, who comes in at minus 225. Now, Charles Oliveira lost to Islam Makhachev, but that's not a fight that he actually lost his title in. If you guys remember when he fought Justin Gaethje, he missed weight and ultimately had to vacate his title, and he ended up winning that night. So his matchup against Islam Makhachev was for the vacant lightweight title, and he ended up coming up short in that matchup. Now let's just dissect that fight a little bit. He gave up two takedowns, I believe, in the first round, but then in the second round was able to stop the takedown approach of Makhachev, forcing Makhachev to strike with him. And then after throwing a wayward flying knee, we saw Makhachev counter effectively with a hook that dropped Charles Oliveira, and then from there, we saw Makhachev go for the sub immediately, able to lock up that arm triangle choke and get the finish. I would have loved to see that fight go on a little bit longer, because who knows what Oliveira would have been able to do in the striking realm, as a lot of people expected him to have the advantage in the striking realm in that matchup. But I think the fear of the potential takedown that was coming his way kind of muzzled him a little bit, which is why Makhachev was able to land that shot that he was able to do. Oliveira followed that up back in June with a dominant victory over Benil Dariush, where he originally got taken down, eventually worked back to his feet, and then really put the pressure on Dariush and got him out of there at the ending of the first round. Oliveira, we know, is on a tremendous run. 12-1 over his last 13 fights. You know, he started off his UFC career 10-8 and then completely flipped the switch a couple years back in his last loss before this run that he's on was in December 2017 to Paul Felder, but since then has just been a rocket ship. Won the lightweight title, defended it a couple times, lost it on the scale, lost to Makhachev, but now positions himself to potentially fight for the title once again if he's able to get his hand raised. We know about his jiu-jitsu, a UFC high or a UFC record, 16 submission victories. He's a killer when he's able to get opponents to the mat, and very aggressive in terms of locking up submissions and trying to take that on home with him. His striking has tremendously improved, which makes him so dangerous all around, because he's able to punch guys into desperation takedowns, then he snatches up their neck, but he's also able to knock down guys, or at least rock guys very badly, just as we saw against Justin Gaethje and Michael Chandler as well. So he's able to do those things. He's going up against a very tough test here, though. Arguably the number two lightweight in the world, Armand Sarukian, who's on a 3-fight winning streak after losing a very close decision to Matias Cameron in June of 2022. But since then, he's finished Joaquim Silva, most recently Beneil Dariush in just over a minute. And then the first win in that 3-5 winning streak was against a very tough Demir Izmagulov. Now, we know what Sarukian's all about, right? He's a guy that goes out there and uses his relentless wrestling approach to really put guys through the grinder. He chain wrestles very well, has a great gas tank. His striking is very much improving, especially with his ability to utilize his power, speed, and explosiveness to land big shots on his opponents and hurt them badly. But it's really his ability to just grind on his opponents, whether it's up against the cage, dragging them to the ground, or just staying consistent with that wrestling style. It's very, very impressive to see. And we saw flashes of that in his UFC debut back in December of 2019 when he signed to the UFC and was thrown to the wolves right away in the form of Islam Makhachev. Even though he was clearly defeated in that matchup, it was a much closer fight than the odds had indicated, which led to a lot of people to believe that these two would eventually fight once again. And this weekend, Sarukian has one more obstacle to overcome before he's able to get that long-awaited rematch against Islam Makhachev. Now, how these two match up? Everybody knows or thinks that Charles Oliveira will likely have the striking advantage in this fight. However, you got to give some credence to Sarukian's ability to put big power on his opponents with his ability to crash that pocket with power and speed. That could potentially open up KO opportunities here against Oliveira, who might have a little bit of a shaky chin, might have some shaky durability. I used to say that Charles Oliveira was a quitter, but I start to eat my words after he's been able to battle back from adversity in a couple of the fights, particularly the Michael Chandler fight, where he was pretty much on the ropes for the majority of that first round, managed to gut it out and then win in that second round and defeat Chandler that night. But it's tough to do that when you're completely knocked out, right? And I think that's a possibility here for Sarukian. Now, if we really want to break down Charles Oliveira's 12-1 run, the first handful of opponents in that 12-fight winning streak, or that 11-fight winning streak, I believe it is, before he lost to Islam Makhachev, a lot of layups, right? Let's be honest. Clay Guida, Nick Lentz, Jared Gordon. Jared Gordon's not a bad fighter, but not of the level of Charles Oliveira. A lot of guys that Armand Sarukian would likely run through. And then we can talk about the Michael Chandlers, the Dustin Poiriers, the Justin Gaethjes. Those guys, in my opinion, will fall short to Armand Sarukian as well. Those guys are the top of the lightweight division, but are a little bit past their prime. Justin Gaethje, obviously turning back the clock here and there, but another fight where, you know, we know that Gaethje doesn't like getting his back taken, and that's potentially where Charles Oliveira was able to take advantage of him there. But, like, I have my question marks about the level of guys that Charles was beating compared to the type of fighter he's fighting this weekend in Armand Sarukian. Sarukian is much more along the lines of Makhachev than any of the past opponents of Oliveira, which leads me to believe that we can see Sarukian control and maintain dominance throughout this matchup. He might get himself into a little bit of trouble here and there, but for the most part, I fully expect Sarukian to stay safe, grind this fight out, potentially even find a knockout. But yeah, I'm going to go with Sarukian here. Sarukian by knockout. It hurts me because I'm a big Charles Oliveira fan, but there's only been a few times that I've picked against Oliveira and actually bet against him as well. Islam Makhachev was one of them, and now Armand Sarukian will be one of them as well. All right, let's move on to the first of three title fights. Technically a title fight, but technically not a title fight. We got the BMF title on the line here as Justin Gaethje looks to defend it, coming in as a minus 160 favorite against the former featherweight champion Max Holloway, who comes in at plus 140. Now on paper, tremendous matchmaking in the fact that both guys throw down, and entertainment-wise, this could be the main event, right? Both guys go out there and put it all out there, right? I'd be very surprised if we see either guy go for a takedown in this matchup, as I think, you know, with this fight being for the BMF title, with this fight being positioned where it is on the card, a lot of people are looking forward to it, anticipating it being an absolute slobber knocker. Now, let's start off on the Justin Gaethje side, who's currently on a 2-fight winning streak. The first of which was him showcasing that he's still deserving of the ranking that he has by defeating up-and-coming hot, hungry lion, young lion, Rafael Fiziev by decision. That was a fight that he started off pretty slow, lost the first round, but managed to battle back in the second two rounds and was able to get his hand raised by decision that night. He followed that up with a knockout victory over somebody who had defeated him prior, Dustin Poirier. Second round head kick knockout. Beautiful work there from Justin Gaethje, who had been getting touched up in that first round by Poirier, but not by a whole lot. I think only two judges ended up scoring that round in Dustin's favor. But Justin ended up getting back in the second round and leaving the judges out of it, getting that knockout victory. We know what Justin's great at, right? He likes to move forward, likes to throw his leg kicks, put some combinations on his opponents, has some deceiving power as well, and has some of the most ridiculous durability that we've ever seen. The last time he lost by TKO, I believe, was 6 years ago. 6 years ago at the hands of Dustin Poirier. And previous to that, he had been knocked out by Eddie Alvarez. But both of those fights were TKOs and not clean knockouts. But it's obvious that you see Gaethje getting hurt, getting rocked, getting wobbled in some of these matchups. And you have to believe that all the wars are slowly starting to catch up to him. And it's going to completely shatter at one point. Remember, for my longtime UFC fans, Chuck Liddell was a guy that used to have insane durability, insane chin. And he'd be able to take some big shots so that he can throw even harder in return and more often than not knock his opponents out. However, at the latter half of his career, his chin did not hold out anymore, and a swift gust of wind could potentially knock him out. Not saying that's going to happen to Justin Gaethje here, but that's definitely something to worry about as he gets closer to his 36th birthday. Now, Justin Gaethje, again, nasty combination striking, good leg kicks, underrated wrestling, but I think he still needs some work in the jiu-jitsu game, as that's where he's suffered his last two defeats as well. His opponent this weekend, Max Holloway, is undefeated since 2013 against opponents not named Alexander Volkanovski and Dustin Poirier. He has defeated everybody else. The Dustin Poirier fight back in 2019 was his bid to go up to lightweight, challenge for the interim lightweight title so that he can become champ, interim champ, as he was the featherweight champion and coming off that shellacking of Brian Ortega prior to that. But it was too much for him, as Dustin Poirier showcased that he was the slicker boxer that night and really touched on Max Holloway over 25 minutes, winning that fight on the scorecards. Let me take you back to 2019, though, because that night, Max Holloway went in as a close to a minus 250 favorite. Not a lot of people were giving Dustin Poirier a chance because of the form that Max Holloway was looking like in 2019, going out there and finishing Jose Aldo twice, going out there and battering Brian Ortega and showcasing that he is one of the best featherweights on the planet, and his boxing game, cardio game, and pace and pressure was absolutely elite. But Dustin Poirier had the perfect answer for him. Was the bigger, the better striker, landed more effective damage, hurting and wobbling Max Holloway a couple times, but was never able to put him completely out. After that, we saw Max Holloway, I believe he won another fight and then eventually lost the title to Alexander Volkanovski, and then had that up and down run where he's defeating everybody else, not named Alexander Volkanovski, but still finding himself at the top of the division. Now with Volkanovski losing, obviously things get a little bit more interesting for Holloway at 145 pounds, but that happened after he had already been booked to fight Justin Gaethje for the BMF title. I think, had that fight not been booked, he might be fighting Ilia Topuria later on this summer for the featherweight title. That could still happen, win or lose, considering this is more of a novelty fight more than anything and shouldn't affect the ranking of Max Holloway in the featherweight division, but it's possible. Now, Max Holloway, we know what he's about. Pace, pressure, combination striking, volume, insane volume, insane chin, ridiculous durability, probably the best chin that we have in the UFC right now, and his ability to just engage in a war and be successful in it. I love what we saw in his last fight against the Korean Zombie, where he was touching up Korean Zombie for the first two rounds. And the beginning of the third round, we saw Zombie come out with a little bit more angst, a little bit more anger, and just wanting to go out there and create a war. He got a war, but we saw some calm and poise and discipline from Max Holloway. Even while Chan Sung-yoon was throwing some crazy strikes at him, he just waited for his opening, landed that overhand right, and that face planted the Korean Zombie, ultimately leading to the finish and the win for Max Holloway. The first finish for him in a long time as well. But he is a fighter that continues to improve even at 32 years old. It's crazy that he's only 32 considering the amount of fights and experience that he has. Now, in this matchup against Justin Gaethje, a lot of people are leaning Gaethje because he is the natural lightweight, and you know his boxing is obviously very difficult to deal with for a lot of fighters. We saw him still capable of defeating guys like Rafael Fiziev, who is younger, and a lot of people were expecting to be the better striker. But there are some question marks about going up against a guy like Max Holloway, who has the durability to deal with the big power that Gaethje brings to the table. Holloway also could potentially have the edge should this fight go into deeper waters, given his ability to put pace pressure and turn it up a notch even when we get into deeper waters. Again, I don't think grappling will be too much of an issue here for either guy. I'd be surprised if either of them actually end up going to the grappling. I think Max Holloway has a very underrated submission game that not a lot of people have really tuned into, because he's just been such a godlike striker over the last couple of years. But this is a tough fight to call. I think this is a closer to a 50-50 fight than the odds currently indicate, which currently has Justin Gaethje around that 60%, between 60 and 65% indicated here. And I have to lean a little bit to the Max Holloway side. He's a little bit closer to his prime, in my opinion, 32 years old, has an insane chin, should be able to start walking down Justin Gaethje in third, fourth, fifth rounds. It's a tough one to call, but I have to lean Max Holloway ever so slightly. Another thing that I'm going to throw out there, and I don't put too much weight on this because I don't like to read into this statistic too much or this trend too much. I like to break down fights as itself, as it's like, you know, like what that fighter has done, their resume, and putting it up against the other fighter's resume, and then seeing their strengths and their weaknesses and how they match up and what can be exploited from either fighter. But this trend has been talked about the last couple of big events. Most recently, we talked about it in the Volkanovski and Topuria event, and it held true that night. But the fighters 35 or older fighting in a title fight below the welterweight division, I believe the record is 35-2 for the fighter that is not 35, the one that is younger. And it held true against Volkanovski and Topuria. Topuria obviously knocking out Volkanovski that night. And this is a title fight in a certain way. It's at 155 pounds. Justin Gaethje's 35 years old. Does it play a factor in this matchup? Let me know in the comment section below what you guys think about that. But I do lean, even without that, you know, throwing that trend, I'm still picking Holloway. I think that we see him turn it up in the latter rounds here. I think it's going to be difficult for Gaethje to battle back from that. I wouldn't even be surprised if Holloway's able to hurt Gaethje and then really start to pour it on him in the third, fourth, and fifth rounds and get a similar TKO the same way that Dustin Poirier and Eddie Alvarez were able to do so. But I think that we're going to take Holloway by decision, but still sprinkle the round three, four, five props because of how live Holloway normally is in the latter half of his matchups. So give me Holloway by decision, but again, round 3, 4, 5 is absolutely live here. All right, moving on to the women's strawweight title fight that we have in the co-main event. We got Zhang Weili coming in at minus 500. She looks to defend her title for the second time as she takes on Yan Xiaonan, who comes in at plus 375. Now, start off on the Weili side, who's on a 3-fight winning streak, which included her bounce-back victory over Ioana Jędrzejczyk after losing her title, or at least losing the second attempt to get her title back against Rosnam Yunus. She bounced back with that nasty spinning back fist knockout against Ioana Jędrzejczyk. Then she followed that up with a dominant performance where she finished Carla Esparza in the second round to win the title again. And then she absolutely dominated Amanda Lemos over 25 minutes to defend her title for the first time during her second title reign. Now, Zhang Weili has made a ton of impressive improvements throughout her career, specifically with her wrestling. We know she came into the UFC as a striker. She had a ton of mixed martial arts background even coming into the UFC, but we would often see her lean on her striking, touching up her opponents, landing big power, using her kicks from distance. That was kind of her game. But over the last couple of fights, we've been looking at her to try to use her wrestling a little bit more to grind her opponents out from that top position. You know, it was very successful against Amanda Lemos, but Lemos, a fighter that deals with a bit of a cardio issue and already does not have a great defensive grappling game, which is why we saw Zhang so dominant in that realm when she was finally able to get the fight there, or when she consistently and got the fight into that realm. Carla Esparza, she was just so much more physically imposing in that matchup that Esparza had no answer for her, right? Esparza, technically speaking, was probably the better wrestler, but she couldn't do anything because of the physical advantage that Zhang Weili had in that matchup. And I think that played a big part in that fight, which is why Zhang made it look so easy that night. She's 34 years old. you know, she's getting close to where things might start to get a little bit shaky for her. I believe she turns 35 in August, if I'm not mistaken. Something to keep an eye on. Is she showing signs of slowing down? Not at all. But age is something that just creeps up out of nowhere, just as we saw with Volkanovski as well. Potentially something to worry about here with Zhang. But regardless, still a dominant champion, still somebody that deserves a lot of respect at the strawweight division. Now, our opponent is getting quite disrespected on the betting line here. I believe it was yesterday or the day before where we saw a ton of action on Zhang Weili come in, pushing her from about minus 350 up to this minus 500 line. But I don't think that you can just discredit Yan Xiaonan so quickly. Now, Xiaonan is now on a two-fight winning streak. I thought she did enough in her Marina Rodriguez fight to actually get the upset victory that night, where she was a near plus 250 underdog, but she ended up on the losing end that night. She got a main event slot against Mackenzie Dern after that, stuffed the majority of takedowns coming her way, still ended up on bottom against a high-level BJJ black belt like Dern, but survived 9 minutes of control time for Dern and looked good doing so. Once she got back to the feet, she got back to her striking advantage and battered her way to a decision victory that night over 25 minutes. She followed that up with a knockout victory over Jessica Andrade. Surprising outcome there. I think that was stopped a little bit too early. It was a great counter shot that Yan landed to drop Andrade. Her head did kind of bounce off the mat, but it seemed like she was fully there even while she was eating those couple of hammer fists that Yan was able to land. But it seemed to me that Andrade was fully back intact by the time the referee stopped the fight. Is what it is, but good win for Yan. I've largely been bigger on Yan than most people in the past. I know her striking is very nasty. It's lethal. On the regional scene, she's producing way more finishes than she has been in the UFC. I think the Jessica Andrade finish is the only finish of her UFC career. But when she throws, it's clear that she lands with a lot of emphasis and a lot of power, which causes a lot of issues for her opponents to try to break that rhythm whenever she gets into it. Her issue in the past has been her takedown defense and her inability to work back to her feet, which is why Carla Esparza was able to finish her in the second round of their fight. That fight was 3 years ago, though. Since then, we've seen Yan team up with Team Alpha Male, as fellow countryman Song Yadong has done over the last several years, and Yan is clearly getting the positives of that partnership with Team Alpha Male. We saw it in the Mackenzie Dern fight. She stopped a lot of the takedowns and she showcased significantly improved submission defense and grappling defense, which is why she didn't get finished by Dern once that fight ended up hitting the mat. And I think that could play a very important role in this matchup against Zhang Weili. In the striking realm, I feel this fight is closer to a 50-50 than the odds are completely indicating. I think the reason that she's minus 500 is people believe that she can replicate what Amanda Lemos was able to do. People are maybe feeding in a little bit too much to that Yan Xiaonan and Carla Esparza fight, not realizing that it was 3 years ago and Yan has clearly made improvements. She's strong. She's, you know, I think she only has an inch reach or a height advantage in this matchup. But in terms of the striking realm, like, it could be competitive. You know, Yan could likely land the better shots down the pipe. I think she's the better puncher. I think Zhang is the better kicker. I think Zhang is the better grappler here, but I don't think it's so much so to the extent that she should be minus 500. You know, Lemos obviously had so many issues trying to work back to her feet, but Yan has a better takedown defense game and she has a better get-up game than Lemos, in my opinion at least. That makes Yan Xiaonan a live underdog in the spot. Now, am I going to pick her to win this fight? Probably not. I think the overarching factor here is that Zhang is just the better overall fighter. Her striking is good enough to be competitive or slightly better than Yan Xiaonan. Her grappling is definitely better because she will be the one likely looking to get that a position, try to establish that dominant top position and try to, you know, mix it up as much as possible, making it look good enough for the judges to eventually get her hand raised on the scorecards if that's how she's able to establish her game plan. That's going to be my official prediction, but by no means am I trying to take that minus 500. I think this fight goes all five rounds. The over 4.5 round pick 'em odds, not a bad spot to take a shot on. But I'm almost forced to take a sprinkle on Yan Xiaonan, hoping that she can showcase good enough takedown defense and good enough get-ups to keep this fight competitive in the striking realm where she could have her moments. Not saying she's going to knock out Zhang Weili, but she could land some big damage here. Make it look good enough for the judges. This is a much closer fight than the odds are indicating. I would put Zhang Weili closer to, you know, minus 185, minus 200, rather than minus 500. insane line, in my opinion. I think she wins. I think she wins by decision. Over 4.5 is what I would predict as my best prediction, per se. But taking a shot on Yan Xiaonan plus 375 is not a bad idea at all. But I'm going to go and still Zhang Weili. All right, main event time. Light heavyweights going at it. Champion Alex Poatan Pajeda coming in at minus 130, taking on former champion Jamahal Hill, who comes in at plus 110. Now, I'll be honest, from jump, I wasn't the most enthused when this fight was announced as the main event for UFC 300. I think it's a little bit, well, you know what, I'll get to the Jamahal Hill side when I get to him. Let's start off on the Alex Pereira side, who is clearly like the next, I guess the next big star in the UFC outside of Conor McGregor, outside of Sean O'Malley. Like, all the big fights have recently included Alex Pereira. He headlined at MSG back in November. He headlined in MSG the week or the year before that against Israel Adesanya when he won the title. Headlined back in Miami in early 2024 or 2023 when he got knocked out by Adesanya. But, like, I guess he's the next big popular star that they have. I can't think of anybody else off the top of my head outside of Sean O'Malley and Conor McGregor. So a very weird situation there, but still, all credit to Pereira. Only one loss in the UFC. This is going to be his eighth fight. Knocking people out, making entertaining fights. All props to him. What won him the fight against Jiří Procházka, he did get taken down in the first round, grinded out for about 2 minutes or so, effectively worked back to his feet eventually. And then in the second round, stuffed the takedown of Jiří Procházka, kept in the striking realm, waited till Procházka got a little bit reckless as he normally does, left that opening for Pereira to land that right and then check left hook that he was able to drop Procházka with, followed up with some ground and pound and was able to get the finish and ended up winning the light heavyweight title, now making him the former middleweight champion as well as the current light heavyweight champion. Absolutely insane what Pereira has been able to accomplish since being in the UFC since 2021. But we know what he brings to the table, right? That check left hook is money. Absolutely nasty. What he's been able to do against a lot of opponents with it. Has a nasty calf kick as well when he's able to establish it. His takedown defense is improving. His get-ups are improving. But it's clear he is most comfortable in the striking realm. And the alliance that he has with Glover Teixeira, probably the best thing that you could do for somebody at his stage of his career and trying to be successful at the highest level, and he has been successful to this point. Now, his opponent this weekend, Jamahal Hill, won the title against Alex Pereira's mentor, Glover Teixeira, back in January of 2023. That was a night where we saw Jamahal Hill stuff 15 of 17 takedown attempts from Teixeira, but even when Hill was taken to the ground, he did a great job in terms of immediately working back to his feet and then getting back to his striking advantage that he was able to damage Teixeira over five rounds, and I believe he won the decision sweeping all five rounds on all three judges' scorecards, making it a very lopsided victory for him that night. I believe he only came in as a minus 120 favorite that night as well. Jamahal Hill, striker, loves to put power on his opponents, does a good job in terms of maintaining his range and putting his power on from distance, sniping his opponents. I've had some issues with his chin up in the air type of striking defense in the past that opponents have been unable to take advantage of. Maybe this weekend is finally when we get to see that, but he's made it work for him. He's gone out there, only lost one fight, which I think was more so to do with his ego when he took or got taken into the guard of Paul Craig and hung out there a little bit too much and got his arm broken. But since then, he's been able to bounce back with four straight victories, including that title-winning effort against Glover Teixeira. And then tragedy struck in July of 2023, where he ruptured his Achilles and then had to vacate the title, or at least he relinquished the title, similar to what the previous title holder did in Jiří Procházka, which is how Jamahal Hill originally got the vacant title shot against Glover Teixeira. Ruptures his Achilles, has surgery July 18th of 2023, and looking through everything, it takes roughly about 6 months, and that's what he's talked about as well, about 6 months to recover, which would place us in mid-January, and then from there, Hill talked about that he would like to return in quarter two of 2024, and we're right at the beginning of quarter two of 2024. I don't know if this is how quickly he wanted to jump back into competition, You know, you have to remember that this fight was announced mid-February. It seemed like the UFC was very much scrambling to try to put together a heavyweight fight. Apparently, he only got the call the day before it was actually announced, or even the day of, if I'm not mistaken. And of course, he said yes. Like, how can you turn down an opportunity to headline one of the biggest events in UFC history at UFC 300, and then to do it for the title that you once had? They probably threw a bag at him as well. That's something to really consider coming into this matchup. Now, I'm not saying that Hill is not completely prepared for this fight, but I think if he had it in his ideal situation, he would probably be fighting in May or June. This might be too quick of a turnaround for him, and especially to come back against such a killer like Alex Pereira. I don't know. Can he take a couple of the kicks? Is he going to be able to have that long range, that distance management that has made him so successful at this stage of his career? It's a lot of questions. Year and a half layoff, coming back against a killer like Alex Pereira. I don't know. It just doesn't add up to me. Hill is capable of pulling off knockouts, right? Light heavyweight. We know one punch can turn anything around, and he's capable of doing that here against Pereira, who had his lights shut out last year, right? It's only been a year since he got knocked out by Israel Adesanya, and by all accounts, maybe Jamal Hill is a bigger puncher than Adesanya. So he's capable of potentially finding that that button on Pereira and putting his lights up. But running the tape, looking over all the facts and everything that I've researched into, I still end up leaning on the champion side in Alex Pereira. Now, I get it. He used to be a 185er, but this guy was made for 205, right? Just looking at the metrics here, 6'4", same as Jamal Hill, 80-inch reach, 1 inch more than Jamal Hill. This is a guy that only went down to 185 to chase that money fight with Israel Adesanya. We know he should have been at 205 this entire time. And it's clear that his punching power is translating to this higher weight class, as we saw against Jiří Procházka last time around. And given some of the striking defense issues that we've seen from Jamal Hill with him, you know, we've been seeing that clip going around social media with him, like crossing his feet. Not a good look in terms of going up against a high-level striker like Alex Pereira, but also leaving his chin in the air when he throws his output. You know, there were plenty of times, even in the Glover Teixeira fight, where you see him unloading on Glover and leaving his chin up in the air, something that Alex Pereira could potentially catch him. You know, that check left hook would be money for him, and he is just the perfect size to land at that range as well. I have to go with Pereira here. You know, small favorite, minus 130, not a bad line. I put him closer to 60%, especially given the injury, the layoff, the comeback, the possible too soon of a comeback from Jamal Hill. I would put Pereira closer to minus 150. So minus 130, I'm happy to take a shot on here. But yeah, I think we see Alex Pereira eventually go out there, find the knockout, and defend his title successfully for the first time. And still, light heavyweight champion Alex Pereira. There you guys go. Main card breakdown for UFC 300, rifling through it. I like to get into, especially with how high level and how monumental this card is, I wanted to get into every matchup as best as I could for you guys and give you guys the best breakdowns. I apologize if I went a little bit too long on some of these fights, but I wanted to like really get my point across in terms of how much I was feeling about these fights. Now, obviously, the quick picks version of the podcast drops on Thursday, so keep your eyes peeled for that, for me to just get straight to the point on every single matchup. But I do appreciate anybody that's been listening to the entire podcast, entire breakdowns. Really, really appreciate it. Reminder, PFL breakdowns will drop on Wednesday as well, so keep your eyes peeled for that. And yeah, that's really about it. Check out the prelim breakdowns if you haven't already. Otherwise, check out all the other great content I'm going to be dropping this week on the YouTube channel. Hit that subscribe if you haven't already. Otherwise, I will see you guys tomorrow for the PFL breakdowns as well as the other two segments that I'll be dropping as well. See you guys then. Peace.
Last thing.